Hello, I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop, and this is the Meet Cute Book Pod. Today, we have the audio from our in-store book launch with author Virginia Heath, whose most recent book, a Regency rom-com called Never Wager with a Wallflower, the third and final book in her Marowell Sisters trilogy, came out last November. Virginia visited the shop all the way from London in late October 2023, which is when this recording was made. Please do excuse the background noise, but please also enjoy the laughter from our live studio audience. In this episode, you'll hear Virginia talk about the Mills and Boone romances she snuck from her mother's stack of library borrows, the bumpy start of her writing career, her take on category versus single-title romance in the world of historicals, writing humor and the roots of her particular sense of humor, her writing process and what happens when the characters take control of the narrative, the joy of finding the right title for a book, what draws her to historical romance, and what historical accuracy in this context means to her, and critically, who plays her favorite Mr. Darcy. Before we transition to that conversation, a little about Virginia. When lifelong insomniac Virginia Heath was a little girl, she made up stories in her head to help pass the time while she was staring at the ceiling. She did this every night for over 40 years, until one day she decided to embrace the insomnia and start writing them down. Now, to her absolute delight and utter astonishment, her slightly racy Regency rom-coms are published in many languages across the globe. When she isn't furiously writing romance fueled on far too much English tea, she likes to travel to far-flung places, shop for things she doesn't need, and drag her long-suffering husband and her devoted Labrador Trevor on long walks around her native London. And, in case you were wondering, 3 Romantic Novel of the Year Award nominations and 30 books later, it still takes Virginia forever to fall asleep. And now, through the magic of podcasting, here's my conversation with Virginia Heath. Do you remember when you started reading genre romance?
Oh, God, yeah. I've always been a reader. And I think quite early on, I found... it's going to be a similar story to everyone says, I found my mum's romances tucked away in her bedside table. And back then they were Mills and Boone. And I remember there was this book, The Doctor's Favourite Nurse. I have no idea, no idea who wrote this book, so I can't credit them with it. But I thought, I am going to give that a go. I think it was probably 9. And it was, well, it was much more exciting than reading Roald Dahl or, you know, the other kind of kid books. And so that kind of started me on that sort of trajectory of romance writing. But yeah, The Doctor's Favourite Nurse by whoever it was back in the 1970s was my first romance.
There was like a whole period of nurse romances that was very popular.
Yeah.
Did you go down a nurse romance rabbit hole?
No, not really. That was just the first book, but I seem to think that she would go to the library and she would, like, you know, we'd be there, we'd be getting our books, me and my sisters, and she would have her couple of romances, and of course, you know, when she was busy and she was doing something, I would sneak upstairs and I would, like, read the chapters along with her. So whatever she picked up, I read. There was no kind of, I couldn't exactly go into the library myself and go, oh, hello, I'll have whatever, you know. I remember there was one, it was quite racy. I was 11 at the time. It was quite shocking because the man put his hand up the lady's dress.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was quite a good one. And then there was another one. What was it? The Virgin Cowgirl says, wow. I mean, who would not want to read? Who would not want to read a book with that title?
I want to read it right now.
No, yeah, I know.
I'm going to find that on eBay. Did you also always want to be a writer?
I think subconsciously, I've always been a storyteller. It says in my bio that, you know, I made up stories in my head, and that's absolutely true. From my earliest memory, I would make up stories in my head. You know, I've never needed much sleep, and I can never get to sleep quickly. And that's how I just kind of would lull my brain off. Even as a child, I would tell myself stories. And So I think it was in me, you know, I think it was there. It was always going to come out. But for it to actually come out, well, that took a long time because I grew up in a very working class family with parents with very low aspirations. I mean, they did the best they could, but my mum was a waitress. My dad was an airport porter. And their aspiration for me was to be a secretary. And I remember saying to them, I want to write books one day. And they just laughed and said, you know, girls like you don't write books. And it was, well, if I can't do that, I'll be a teacher. And they were like, well, you can't do that either. And actually, I went into teaching first. It was kind of like my second choice. And I kind of thought, I was like, I used to say to my students, I taught teenagers for my sins. And I used to say, I know. And with teenagers, you're either strict or you're funny or they eat you alive. So I chose funny. And I used to say to them all the time, I'm going to write a book one day. And I think I was like, how old was I? Probably about 46. And I said it, and they say, I'm going to write a book one day. And this student who I'd taught for 5 years, he said, I've had you for 5 years. You've been saying that for 5 years. You're never going to write a book. And it was kind of like, oh, I better get on and do it then, really, hadn't I? So, yeah, it took me a long time to actually have the courage to put the words down on paper. But I've always been a storyteller.
I love when people have writing as a thing that they didn't like start professionally when they were 20. Like, you can start it later. You can be a writer when you're 40 or 60.
Yeah, or when you're 16. There is no, you know, I think I've always loved to read, and I think that's the key. You know, if you love stories, it doesn't matter whether you make them up yourself or whether you're reading somebody else's. I've always been a reader, and I think I can't imagine how many thousands of books I've read in my lifetime, but they're my training course for what I do now. You know, you work out what works, and subconsciously, subliminally, you pick all these things up. So yeah.
Are you a fast reader?
Yeah, but not like a speed reader. I do like to, if I'm going to read a book, I like to savor it. I don't like to feel like, you know, it's a pressure. I can read, if I get into a book, I'm terrible. If I get into a book, I'm like, you won't see me for 2 days. I'll like surface for meals, go to bed when I have to. But I can get through a book in 2 days. But that's when a book's so good, you know, when you just don't want to put it down. It's like, well, you know, just one more chapter. But yeah, I'm a fast reader because I suppose I read a lot, but I savor it.
Yeah. So your first published book, what was it?
That Despicable Rogue was my first published book.
Okay, great title.
A fantastic title. And there's a story to that title if you want me to bore you with it.
I do.
I'd written a couple of books when I decided I was going to write a book. I wrote my first historical. Really, it was a hysterical. It was so bad. And then I wrote another one. And then I wrote another one. And then one day I was like, the glamorous life of an author. And I was vacuuming. And this title popped into my head, That Despicable Rogue. And I thought, oh, whoever wrote that book, I need to read it. And so I've gone on, clicked onto Amazon, looked for it. It didn't exist. And I thought, then I have to write it. And the only thing I knew about the book was he was a rogue and he was despicable. I mean, it's all right. So yeah, so that was my first book. And it was funny because I'd written those three books before and I'd only ever sent the first one off. You know, I'd thought that the hysterical would, that I'd written this book, so therefore it had to be published, you know, sent it off to all these publishing agents, like, and I thought, there's going to be a bidding war, you know, I'm going to be the next J.K. Rowling. I got 6 replies from the 46 people I sent them to, and all of them were, don't call us, we'll call you. So it wasn't very encouraging, so it was a real confidence knock. So when it came to writing That Despicable Rogue, it felt different. And I think, in a way, those first three books, I was finding my voice. And I think that's, you know, you have to learn what your author voice is, what you sound like on paper. And I'd read so many of other people's books. You have to kind of, so they were my training course. So they were essential. But yeah, my first published book, I wrote it in 6 weeks as well, which was mad. It just kind of fell out of me, this book. And there was this competition, So You Think You Can Write, and Harlequin were looking for authors. Well, Mills and Boone is the English version. And they were looking for, like, this competition. And so I entered it. And it was doing well. They had it, they put it on Wattpad and people were reading it and they had a vote on it. It was doing well. And I became, like, absolutely obsessed with people reading my book on Wattpad. Oh, how many people have read it today? And then I kind of, I was so obsessed, I read the rules. I read the rules and it said, you can't have submitted this book anywhere else, but if you've already submitted it to Mills and Boone, that's okay. And I thought, oh, belt and braces, we have a saying in the UK, belt and braces. So I thought, well, I'll submit it to them. And an editor, within like 5 days, this editor contacted me and it was a very lovely rejection. And it said, it's not suitable for publication yet, but if you were to work on this and work on this and work on this, then, you know, I'd be happy if you resubmitted it. And so I spent 2 weeks, I didn't bother like doing any washing, any laundry, left my children to starve, you know, just fed them chocolate. And I thought, I'm gonna do what they say. And it was, and so I sent it back. And 2 weeks later, I got this other very polite email rejection, but this one wasn't so much a rejection. It was more specific. And it said, like, you know, this middle bit of the book is really kind of flat. It loses things. So, you know, work on those and send it back. Another 2 weeks went by. My kids started to get scurvy because they were like, I was feeding them cat food by that stage. And we all stunk because I'd done nothing. And again, then I sent it off to her again. And then I got the worst email in the world. And it was, I think it's time for a second opinion. That's all this email said. I think it's time for a second opinion. At which point I was like, oh, and that's it, you know, what the?
Why wouldn't she just get a second opinion? Why would she email that to you?
I don't know, horrible. But it had a dot, dot, dot on the end as well. It was like, it was a total cliffhanger email. And so, like, it was 2 weeks again, 2 weeks went by which time I was tearing my hair out. I was like, oh my God, you know, is this it? And then I had to give myself a talking to, and I thought, well, do you know what? If nothing else, I've been working with an editor in a major publisher, and the feedback that they have given me has helped me progress. So I need to pull on my big girl knickers, and I need to use that to write the next book. And I sat down at my computer, no word of a lie, and I started writing the next book, and the phone rang. And that's when I got my first 2-book contract. So yeah, that was the story of That Despicable Road, my vacuuming title.
I'm so stressed out by that story.
The dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, I can't believe, can you imagine sending that email to someone? Oh, torture.
My God, it was awful, it was awful.
Wild. Okay, so those are category romances.
Yes.
So, like, the slightly shorter, they have sort of parameters that you write to.
Well, I think this is an interesting thing about category romances. I mean, the historical category romances are not like the shorter ones, the contemporary ones. They're longer. They're between 75,000 and 80,000 words.
That's like a trade paperback.
And a trade paperback starts at 80,000 to like 100,000 words. And I think this idea that perhaps I write differently for my trade books, the Merriwell sisters and my Harlequin books, it's just not the case. It's still me, still this, you know, slightly peculiar, weird, awkward, British, sarcastic voice. So it's still me. The difference, is that I think it's a really good way to learn how to structure a book and to keep focus on the romance and the what needs to be in the book. You know, you have to strip out a lot of the waffle that you might be tempted to put in it. The difference with my Merriwells to my backlist with Harlequin is that I'm allowed to put more characters in. I'm allowed to kind of, like, put more, you know, the focus in it, because the books are shorter, the focus is always on the couple. Whereas in my Merriwells, I can bring in these other mad characters who do their weird and wonderful things and interfere and make people laugh. So they, yeah, so that's a, the difference.
Interesting. Do you have a preference?
For what? Which ones I write?
Like, if they're like, you're on a desert island and the desert island will only allow you to write single title or category romance for the rest of your life.
Do you know what? I just write my stories. And I've got a couple of category romances that I am really incredibly proud of. Regency rom-coms, they stand on their own two feet. And I would put them up against my Merriwells. I mean, I've got one called The Discerning Gentleman's Guide, which was the first time I got shortlisted for the Romantic Novel of the Year Award in the UK. I'm immensely proud of that book. And I think it would stand on a trade shelf, you know. So I don't have a preference. I just like to write my stories. I just like to write what I like to write. And I'm glad that two publishers like what I write enough to want to print it. It's a privileged position to be in.
And lots of readers.
Yeah, yes, lots now.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the humor. Your books are very funny, which is hard to do. It's hard to get writing to feel alive and funny in that way. First of all, where does your sense of humor come from, do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm British. And as a nation, we are ridiculous and we're aware of it. So sarcasm is kind of hardwired into us Brits. And we do see the ludicrousness of life and how ridiculous we are. Also as well, like I said at the beginning of this, I used to teach teenagers and I found that it was a sort of just slightly out of inner city school in an underprivileged area. And I loved those kids to death, but they could be difficult. They could be challenging. And so I worked out that I could teach them history and they would love history so long as I was a bit of a stand-up comedian while I did it. And I don't know. I don't think of myself as funny, but I am aware of the fact that people laugh at me often, and I'm never quite sure if whether they're laughing at me or with me. But either way, I'm happy with it.
What is the process of writing humor like for you? Does it pours out of you? Or are you like punching up your jokes a lot on like a second or third draft?
See, again, so the second and third draft. I don't do a second or third draft. Every writer's different. So for me, I can't plot. I've tried plotting, it didn't work for me. I had this wonderful plot, took me days, and the story went that way almost straight away and the plot went out the window. So I can't plot. I open up my computer and I look at a blank screen and I go into a zone where I see and hear the story and the characters like a film in my head. And what I do is I just write down what they're doing. I know that sounds bizarre, and I did tell you I was weird, but that's what happens. So the humor just naturally happens. You know, the characters just speak and things are funny. And sometimes I kind of, there are certain times where you think to yourself, okay, I'd like to put something funny in here, and you'll have to think of a scene. And so in Never Wager with a Wallflower, there is a scene in Never Wager with a Wallflower. It involves two orphans and a basket full of pigeons and the hero. And it was kind of like, I wanted to do something to show the heroine what sort of a guy he was, because there is an enemies to lovers romance. And so they kind of, you know, they butt heads all the way through. But it was also a good opportunity to kind of like play around and do some different things and just to make the audience laugh. So I did kind of think about that scene for a while to work out like, well, what could I do that would make people laugh? But when you write humor, you have to be very careful. You've got to, it's got to be feasible and believable. otherwise it just becomes a bit slapstick. And I think if it's feasible and it could naturally happen, then it's funny. But if it's too contrived, and I do think that sometimes newer writers maybe, or they think that humour is like constant banter between people, and that, you know, and they'll write, oh, that's hilariously funny, and they'll say things like that. They'll like try and tell the audience how to feel about it. Whereas I'll actually just, I prefer to just, you know, I find life, like I said, ridiculous. I find people ridiculous. We do strange things. People in love do the strangest things possible. And there's humour to be had in all things. Even the darkest moments, there's humour to be had. So, yeah, it just happens. It's not something that I put a great deal of thought into, because what goes on in my odd head is what comes out on the page.
That's so interesting. The writing where it just, like, the story is telling itself in your head sounds very much like when you would fall asleep telling yourself stories. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting is I hear their voices, and there's always, like, they're there, and I'll hear the external characters doing things. And I'll sometimes be at my computer and they'll be doing things like they're not meant to do. I remember there's a particular book that is quite a reader favourite from my category romance ones. It's called His Mistletoe Wager. And quite early in the book, I'm writing this scene and suddenly the hero proposes to the heroine. And I'm shouting at my computer screen while I'm actually going, well, this should not be happening now. This is too early. What are you doing? And like my son, who again thinks I'm slightly bonkers, he kind of came out of his bedroom and I found him looking at me like talking to my, but still furiously typing, because they're still talking to me, but I'm shouting at them. And he went, you know, when you end up in your home, this is why I am going to send you to a home.
So you are not a plotter, but this is a series of books that are interrelated.
Yes.
So how do you approach that as a person who's not really a plotter?
Okay. So when I came up with the idea of the Merriwell sisters, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to write a series about sisters? And I'll have three of them, because, you know, that always causes conflict. Any odd number always causes conflict. And I thought, oh, let's make them poor. I love Oscar Wilde, and The Importance of Being Earnest is one of my absolute favourite plays, and I love his humour, but I also love the sitcom Frasier. And you know when Frasier, like, it'll be perfectly normal and then it will just descend into this kind of farce and everything will go wrong. And I thought, well, what if I kind of played around with that, and what if I kind of did my own version of The Importance of Being Earnest with somebody pretending to be somebody else? But in this case, it was, you know, Hugh pretends he has a fiance called Minerva. And then his mother comes over expecting to meet this fiance that he's been fobbing her off with for years. And he happens to meet this woman in the street and her name's Minerva. So he offers her money to, you know, to pose as his fiance. And I just knew... That was the idea. And then I had these two sisters and their characters kind of developed in that story. And then from that story, I kind of got the idea of the second one. The characters tell me what they want to do. That again, doesn't that sound like really pretentious? Oh, my characters tell me what they want to do. But that's the truth of it, you know. My ideas are like literally five bullet points. Oh, I wonder if this would make a book. It's not a healthy way to write, you know. There's got to be easier ways of doing it.
I mean, it's working.
It's working, yeah.
You know, don't fix it if it's not broken. I'm sorry. I was on vacation last week. My brain is not 100%
back
online. That's
okay. I'm jet lagged, so trust me. You know, all sorts could come out of my mouth in a minute.
We've talked about titles a little bit. Do you like titling books? Do you hate titling books?
I love titling books. And the titles for this series, actually, I had a couple of titles. I always like to have a title at the front. When I start that blank document and I'm banging my head against the wall, I'll always put a nice swirly font up the top and I'll put a title. And the title might change as I'm writing it. And with Never Fall for Your Fiancé, it had a different title. I can't remember what it was. It was rubbish. But his best friend was like lecturing him in this scene. Like saying, like, this is because he sees the hero in the first book looking a bit longingly at the heroine who's pretending to be his fiance. And he says to him, you know, the first rule of this is you never fall for your fiance. And as soon as I wrote that line, I thought, that's it. There's my title. And once I got that first one, I loved the fact that it started with never. I don't think many books ever start with never. And then fall for your fiance. Oh my goodness, that alliteration, my little writer's heart. It did a leap, it did. And then I thought, right, well, I need the second book to follow that. So that became Never Rescue a Rogue. And then I'm like, okay, what am I going to do for number three? So this is true. I came up with Never Wager with a Wallflower. And I came up with that like, at the beginning of book two. So I thought, well, okay, book three is going to have gambling in it somewhere. So then I had to weave into book two the idea of this kind of gambling future for book three. So that's how the stories came about. The stories, book three came out of the title.
Again, whatever works. All right. Do you write exclusively historical romance?
I have. But I have decided to have a go at a contemporary rom-com. I know. So I thought, play to my strengths, British, I'll have a fish out of water. So I've started it. I've got an American hero in a British Cotswolds village trying to turn an old stately home into a hotel, and the villagers, like, obviously want his head on a pike for daring to want to like modernize something that's falling down. So
great, I will read that.
That's oh yeah. So I've got to finish writing it, and then I've got to convince a publisher to publish it. But yeah, I'm going to give it a go.
Very exciting, breaking news.
Breaking news, you heard it here first.
Okay, won't ask you a million questions about a book you haven't finished writing, but you historically have written historicals.
Yes.
What is it that draws you to historical romance? Oh.
Men in breeches. works for me. Mr. Darcy in a wet shirt. I love the time period. And again, I think this goes back to me being a secondary school teacher in England. When they're like 14, year nine, we call it in England, they have to do the Industrial Revolution, which everything I could find on the Industrial Revolution, every textbook, was the dullest thing ever. And I thought, I just cannot teach it like this. So I went off on a bit of a quest to try and make it interesting. And I realized that actually all the textbooks were being really unfair, because that whole 1800 to 1900 period is just so fascinating. You know, you go from the beginning of it where like there aren't machines, and then there are, and people didn't understand what caused illnesses, and suddenly we know about germs, and you know, we've gone from riding a horse to steam trains and motor cars, and the Wright brothers trying to, you know, fly planes. A whole like century of revolutions, including the kind of social revolutions that happened, especially in England, like the vote, the changing in the class systems, you know, I think it's a fascinating time. And I think England was really, really lucky that we didn't have a kind of French Revolution style affair where all the aristocrats had their heads chopped off, because I do think it came very, very close. But I found it such a fascinating period. So it's a rich seam to mine. I like plenty of things you can do with it. And because of that, I try to avoid, I have my lords and I have my dukes, and you know, they're sexy, but there always has to be more. And I like to play it up. I like to play with the class system. I like to do the social history stuff. I just like to, you know, take a different path sometimes to what is considered. Oh God, I just did air quotes. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I loathe people that do air quotes, and I just did them to you, and I'm ashamed of myself.
It's the jet lag.
We'll blame the jet lag.
Yeah. So you were a history teacher.
Yes.
How important to you, there's a wide array of opinions about how much we care about historical accuracy and historical romance and what that even means. How much do you care about that? What does that mean to you?
Okay, so the historian in me means that aspects of what I do have to be completely accurate. So obviously I'm that rare beast. I am a British Regency writer, talking about writing novels set in London, but I actually live there, which most of the Regency authors have never even set foot there. So I like every street name you see in one of my books, they all exist. Every shop, every business, they're all real. I do my research. Things that have happened, you know, it's always completely accurate, those things. But I am not writing... I'm not writing a history textbook. I'm writing fiction for modern readers, in the same way that Jane Austen wrote fiction for modern readers back when in her day, and Shakespeare did in his. So I think, I'm not comparing myself to either of those, by the way, before you kind of, I'm just using it as an example, but I think we have modern sensibilities, so why am I going to write a book where they're all hither and thithering, and the hero's going to go off shagging whoever he wants because he's allowed to because he's a man, and the women have to? Why would I do that? You know, why would I actually have like people that don't bathe during the winter months? You know, what's sexy about that? And also, why would I have a heroine who behaves herself? Not that I think women in history did behave themselves. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that women most definitely did not behave themselves. They always pushed boundaries and did the unexpected. And so I like historical accuracy, but it's a backdrop. And I am not writing books. I'm not writing books for people to... I want people to fall into my stories. I want them to love my characters. I want them to root for them. And I also think that people have always been people with the same anxieties, the same thoughts. I don't think it matters what time period you write in. I'm sure there were Vikings, you know, Viking pillagers running around like going, you know, I'm not sure what I'm questioning my life choices. Is this the right way to behave? People have always been people. And I think that there's a balance. And yes, the history police sometimes like go, well, she wouldn't have behaved like that. You go, no, of course she wouldn't. And wouldn't that be a boring book? This is fiction. I'm writing fiction. I'm writing happily ever afters. You know, I'm selling a dream. Well, it's nice. You just want to escape your life for a while. Why has it got, why do I care that somebody wouldn't say couldn't? And he would say, oh, thither over yonder. Oh, yeah, I can't be bothered.
Very fair. I've never noticed, so. So wait, so in terms of dialogue, you have an American hero in this book, in Never Wager with a Wallflower.
Yes.
You are not American.
No.
Usually, I'm talking to American authors who I'm like, how are you writing this to sound British? Not that I would ever know, right? Like, I'm American, so I'll read a book, I'm like, it sounds British. Fine. But was it hard to write an American character, or are you like steeped enough in American media?
Okay, so I've been coming to America regularly now for a good few years as a writer. And I have a lot of American friends, and obviously as the world is steeped in American culture, you know, especially now with like, the culture gets swapped. You have like whatever it is, BritBox, and we have HBO, and so you understand. I do understand like the different things, and I'm not trying to. He is a fish out of water, my American character, but you know, I don't think British and American people are really that different. Well, we are in some things, but you know, we're kind of like, it's just accents and slight changes in like, you know, experience. I think we're similar nations, mostly. Don't honestly get me started on your tea, but you know, mostly.
For years, I thought a lieutenant and a lieutenant were just different things.
That's the pronunciation. Yeah,
I really thought that that was a different word that I had just never seen in print.
I put it in a book, didn't I? I
wrote
left. Yeah, lieutenant, and he's hearing it like she says it phonetically.
Yeah,
lieutenant. I know it's funny, like different words, the way you say things. Like the big one now is like, I suppose we say aluminium and you say aluminum.
I think you spell it differently.
Yeah,
too.
We do.
Yeah,
that is one weird thing though. So St. Martin's, obviously, my agent is American, my publisher is American. So I write my books in English with my English spellings, and then St. Martin's put all the American spellings in. And they did try and put gotten in my books. They tried to change my gots to gottens, and I'm like, that is a hill I am prepared to die on. I have two American characters. They are allowed to say gotten. No Brit, past or present. It's not in our lexicon. It's not in our language. So it's like, you remove those gottens. You can change my colour to colour. You can change neighbour to neighbour. But you are not. My British characters, they are not going to say gotten. And it's funny because it's like, you know, that's my one. And I'll do the edits, come back and I will do a search. Gottens. Where are the gottens? Where are the gottens? And I'll check. Oh, it's okay. It's the American characters. That's okay. I actually congratulated them on this. I went, thank you so much. Three books it's taken for them not to put gottens in. But this time they were like, don't add additional gottens. Only the Americans can say gotten.
Your copy editor was like receiving memos.
Yes, she was. Change all the spellings you want, but not the word gotten.
All right. We've talked a little bit about future contemporary book that you are drafting, but what is your next book coming out?
So St. Martin's have commissioned me to do another series for them, Miss Prentice's Protégés, and they're a bunch of four friends, female friends, and they're in a school for girls that teaches them to be governesses and companions and, you know, secretaries. Like, they're not aristocratic. There's gentry in their family, but they've got no money, and it's like to keep them on the periphery, and they're supposed to be well-behaved young ladies. And obviously, big surprise, they're not. And so the first of that is called All's Fair in Love and War, and it comes out on the 28th of May. It's all written. I kind of pitched it to St. Martin's as The Sound of Music meets Mr. Darcy. So it's, you know, it's kids, a governess and a man who likes everything shipshape and Bristol fashion. So obviously to torture him, I just like put a tornado right through the center of his life. That's what I did.
And that's out in May.
That's out in May. And I'm currently writing, I said, this is why I've had to pause the contemporary. I'm currently writing the second of that, which is called Look Before You Leap. So I'm kind of about 30,000-40,000 words into that one. So that'll be the following May 25. Oh, everything's like deadlines for the future, but yeah.
The publishing timelines are so wild.
Yeah.
Like 2025 is so far away, but also in publishing time, it's like tomorrow.
I know. But I'll write a book. So like Never Wager with a Wallflower, I finished that 18 months ago and now it's coming out. And like when you just said to me about lieutenant,
like, I put that in
a book. You went, you put it in this one. I'm like, did I?
Well, you haven't read it in a long time.
And I've written books since then. Like, yeah.
That's so funny. All right. Well, do we have any audience questions?
So do you have any like friends or enemies that you write them into a book?
Yes. Yes, I have. So I've got a good friend called Paul Lovett, and he said, I want you to put me in a book. I went, okay, I will. So I made him the butler in The Discerning Gentleman's Guide. He was Lovett, and him and my husband, he's my husband's best friend, and whenever they drink port together, they kind of both list, and Paul always lists to the left, and my husband lists to the right, and they just kind of like gradually sort of slide down the seat. So I put that in a book. And I have put somebody in a book, and I can't tell you who because they'll find out. But I have put a rather obnoxious member of my extended family in a book, and put that person's mannerisms in and the sort of things that they do, and made them the baddie, and cracks me up that my editor at the time, oh my God, this is awful. I can't, if this, just in case it slips out who it is, I'll tell you all when the recording's finished. But my editor afterwards, like, said, I really love the story. But, you know, you really need to tone down that character. Nobody would behave like that. It's a bit pantomime, and I'm thinking, I've just put what they actually do in this book. But okay. Truth is stranger than fiction, so I put them in and had to tone them down because they were just too obnoxious.
You must have felt really vindicated, though.
Do you know what? It was kind of cathartic. It was a person that always just annoyed me. Just, oh, you know, you have those people who just want to yuck on your yum, and they're like that. I'm being very good with my pronouns as well, though. You've got no clue. And they're like that. And it was, I wrote it. And now when they say the things they say, I just think, you are a sad, bitter and twisted individual. And I've put you in a book.
Every book I read of yours now, I'm going to be like, who's the character?
But I think sometimes, as an author, you do kind of like, you'll find like some real like mannerisms that people have, and you just think that's quite funny, you know. And you kind of watch people. I was on a train a couple of months ago, minding my own business, reading a book, and someone's talking on a phone. This girl was talking on a phone, and it's got to go in a book one day, but I don't know where to put it. But This woman said, I told him, I'm not doing that anymore. Bloody hurts. And I'm like a meerkat. And I'm trying to tune into the rest of the conversation. Then she's like, oh, it's my stop. And she got off. And I'm just left hanging. And I don't know what it was that happened. I've got a very vivid imagination. But, you know, that's a magnificent, you know, what a line to start a book with. You'd be like, I wish to read on.
How inconsiderate of her to get off the train I mean, you'll never know. Okay, I have a question.
Go on then.
You've mentioned Mr. Darcy multiple times. Which is your... That is... You gotta, you know, you're like, I gotta answer that. It's an alert. Which is your...
This is my teacher hard stare now. She's getting...
That's very... I'm...
That you're withering, you're withering, yeah. Go ahead.
You have to teach me that. Who is your sort of like favorite of the Darcys in the various film adaptations?
Oh, Colin
Firth.
Or
what's your favorite? Okay, thank you.
Oh, it's Colin Firth. It can't be topped. Nobody smoulders across a piano more than Colin Firth. I mean, he just, the love, the repression in his eyes, but the love is just so beautiful. I mean, who wouldn't want to just, I love his version of Mr. Darcy. I do, there is one bit in the Matthew McFadden version that, yes, is the hand. Just that thing where they touch hands and then he just, his little repressed fist kind of opens up and shuts again, and it's beautiful. But I just think, yeah, I do. Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy, and Richard Armitage in North and South. Yes. Oh my goodness, what I would do to that man!
I just came across that once, that version of it by accident. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I was delighted, but I thought I had like discovered something that no one knew about. So I'd be like, hey, found this movie.
Oh, best screen kiss ever in that. Yes. At the train station. Oh my goodness. fanning myself now. For the recording, I'm fanning myself.
For those at home.
For those at home listening in.
All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This has been delightful.
And there you have it. A huge thank you to Virginia Heath for visiting us all the way from England. If this conversation has made you want to pick up copies of her Merriwell Sisters series, you can do that in our shop or on our website, meetcutebookshop.com. You can also pre-order her next book, All's Fair in Love and War, out May 28th. If you've been enjoying this podcast, I would so appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review it on the podcast listening platform of your choosing. It helps other people find us, and that helps us keep making podcasts. That's all for this episode of the Meet Cute Book Pod. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop in San Diego, California, and I hope you'll tune back in for more deep dives into romance writing, reading, and publishing.